Mr. Dunfield, judges, Chief Justice Fisher, may it please the court. This is an honesty case. In 1996, respondent Dustin Dunfield was charged with the crime of statutory rape. December of that year, he pled guilty to the charge of statutory rape and received a 2-year suspended imposition of sentence, or SIS. Several years later, Mr. Dunfield applied and was admitted to law school, was applied and admitted to the Missouri Bar. In February 2014, Mr. Dunfield declared his candidacy for the prosecuting attorney of Vernon County, Missouri. As a requirement under state law to do that, he was required to fill out and complete a candidate declaration form, which has been provided to the court. That form clearly states on its face, "I further declare that I have not been convicted of or found guilty of or pled guilty to a felony under the laws of Missouri." It further requires the candidate to swear or affirm that the information contained in the declaration of candidacy is true. Mr. Dunfield's statement in declaring on the candidate declaration form that he had not been convicted of, not pled guilty to a felony under the laws of Missouri, was a false statement. The sitting prosecuting attorney, Lynn Ewing, challenged Mr. Dunfield's candidacy and brought the attention to the matter of the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. This matter proceeded to a hearing in front of a disciplinary hearing panel in Springfield, Missouri in December of last year. At the conclusion of the hearing, the disciplinary hearing panel found that Mr. Dunfield had violated Rule 4-8.4C, which is conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. The panel recommended that Mr. Dunfield be suspended and that said suspension be stayed and placed on a period of probation for 2 years. Before this court today, the only thing that is challenged by the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel is the amount of the punishment in this case. We believe the facts of this case, this court's pre-existing case law and the ABA standards, that a 1-year suspension from the practice of law is the appropriate discipline to be imposed in this case. Specifically, we believe there's 4 reasons that a 1-year suspension is appropriate in this case under the facts. First of all, Mr. Dunfield's come forward with no evidence. It's been his position that he answered this thing truthfully because he thought he had an SIS and could therefore answer this question in the negative. Well, it clearly states again on his face, pled guilty to a felony under the laws of Missouri. He presented no credible evidence at the disciplinary panel hearing supporting any of his reasons for answering that. Second reason, and we believe this is an aggravating factor, and under existing Missouri Supreme Court case law, specifically the Cruz case, his multiple explanations since 1996 about whether or not he did in fact plead guilty or was found guilty by the court have varied. Clearly, the record that's before this court shows that his plea was done in accordance with Missouri law. He filled out a plea form, he answered all those questions, he was advised by the judge on the record about the consequences of entering his guilty plea. The next year, he hired a private attorney. He could have collaterally attacked his plea at that time, but he did not do so. When he applied for admission to the University of Arkansas Law School, when he applied for admission to the Missouri and Arkansas bars, he disclosed that he pled guilty. Fast forward to 2014, after his candidacy was challenged, he's contacted by the Nevada paper, and he denies that he pled guilty and says he did not, in fact, plead guilty. We then get forward to the answer that was filed by my office in this case, in which case I asserted facts alleged that he pled guilty in 2 separate places in the information, and this is important. He admitted that he pled guilty in his answer to the information. He's since gone back on that and said, well, that was inadvertent, I didn't mean to do that. But again, Your Honors, that appears twice in the brief that he pled guilty. At the hearing, it's a disciplinary hearing, I asked him several specific questions asking for just a yes or no answer as to whether or not he had pled guilty, and it took about 2 pages of answers to finally get a yes or no answer out of him as to whether or not he pled guilty. So he's been all over the place and offered different multiple explanations of whether or not he pled guilty, and it's basically whatever suits him at that time, being when you're applying for admission to the bar or facing a disciplinary action, whether or not you pled guilty.
But do I understand correctly now that that conviction's now been set aside, or that guilty plea?
That is correct, Judge Steeth, but I don't think that's relevant
to
any of the issues.
So then why ask if it's relevant or not at this point?
I don't believe so, Judge. That conviction was not set aside until August of 2016.
The guilty plea, and I called it conviction, sorry, guilty
plea. Right. Well, it was the guilty plea was set aside in August of 2016. The candidate declaration form was completed in February of 2014. At the time he filled out the candidate declaration form, he still had the guilty plea, and that had not been removed.
And you're not suggesting the sanction should be because of the guilty plea, but because he was not honest in answering, in filling out the candidate declaration form?
That's correct, Justice Steve. The only issue that we're concerned about is his honesty at the time he filled out the candidate declaration form, and then as an aggravating factor, as I've discussed here, his kind of explanation since that time.
Thank you.
Yep. I think the third factor that weighs in favor of a one-year suspension in this case is the public interest, the protection of the public, which this court is always asked to consider in any discipline case. The office for which Mr. Dunfield was applying was the chief law enforcement officer for Vernon County, Missouri, which has 21,000 Missourians in it. It's often been said the prosecutor holds the front doors to the courthouse and the keys to the back door of the jail. If you look at, you know, when I cite in my brief, I discussed the Duke lacrosse case, and I'm not saying we're to that level of misconduct here, but you are talking about someone who's applying to be a law enforcement officer and uphold the law. I mean, the expectation of being honest and forthcoming should be above board in all instances there. The last factor that we believe warrants in favor of a one-year suspension in this case, and these are aggravating factors under the ABA standards, are one, that Mr. Dunfield had a dishonest motive. Clearly, at the time that he filled out the candidate declaration form, I mean, I can't speculate as to what was in his head, but you know, there was probably some belief that it was people wouldn't find out about it or that type of thing, but he did it thinking that he could get elected to the office. I think that's another issue I wanted to go back to briefly on protection of the public. Had he in fact been elected and this had come out later, he would have had to been removed through an extraordinary writ, which would have further burdened the courts, the people of Vernon County, and there would have been probably had to been a special election. The other thing is, again, and this goes back to his multiple explanations, is at no point throughout this entire process has Mr. Dunfield ever admitted wrongful conduct or expressed any type of remorse. If you look throughout the record in this case, in his 1996 plea, he was represented by a public defender. It was their fault. It was the prosecuting attorney's fault. It was the judge's fault. He wasn't properly advised of his plea. He blamed the victim and the victim's mother for what went on in that case as well. He blamed his private attorney in 1997 for not collaterally attacking his plea. He blamed the sitting prosecutor, Lynn Ewing, who is the only person, as I understand, under the law, to challenge, has standing to challenge the candidacy, for being political and playing political games. And most recently, in this brief that he filed with this court, he's accused my office, and more specifically me, because he uses the male pronoun, of being dishonest to this court. No point has he ever accepted responsibility, blames other people, and I think the most telling example of that, Your Honors, if you look at his brief, page 45 of his brief, he's talking about whether if the court does decide whether to give him probation, and he's arguing for no discipline, which I would submit is completely inappropriate. The Kriegel decision from this court addresses that. In page 45, he's saying if the court does give him probation, he can be monitored because respondent has not refused to accept responsibility, nor does he have a tendency to blame others. Immediately preceding that, on page 44 of his brief, he states, respondent has at times in the recent past, under oath, stated that the judge and his public defender did not correctly apply the law and or provided him with ineffective assistance of counsel. So there's a really big...
Well, since it was set aside, that one seems reasonable, doesn't it?
I would say, Judge, that that's a correct statement of the law as it exists today because the fact that...
I mean, you are allowed to protest your innocence if you think you are, and that's not refusing to accept responsibility. You have other instances that you've referred to, but...
Right. I think that's fair, Judge, in the sense that it has been set aside. I mean, I don't think it's relevant or worth my time to get into the long, convoluted process that it got there, but I would say in the sense that a court did find that, you could say that that was, in fact, reason there. In any event, Judge, to conclude today, we think a one-year suspension is appropriate. You know, there are a number of cases that this court has considered in the past with respect to honesty. I think if you read, and I've cited a number of those cases in my brief, what's happened in honesty cases when the court has entered a lesser sanction, and I'm thinking specifically of the couples case. There were two couples cases, and he was back before this court the next year and received a harsher punishment. But The case law is clear that allegations of dishonesty, misrepresentation should be dealt with harshly by the court. We think the facts of this case support a one-year suspension from the practice of law. Seeing no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Your Honors, and Mr. Rapp, may it please the court. After listening to Mr. Rapp's arguments and the things that have been litigated over the past several years in regards to these events, back in 1996, when I entered that plea, I didn't realize what was really going on at the time. I was 21 years old. I had recently, just a few years before that, had broken my neck, was completely paralyzed, told that I would never walk again. I know we don't really need to get into the facts of all those things, that this has already been litigated and set aside. But my point is, my state of mind at the time, whenever I filled out the candidacy form back in 2014 as to whether I was eligible or not to run for prosecuting attorney, I had spoken to a local judge and had talked to my former public defender, had gotten a hold of the Missouri Ethics Commission, and everyone that I spoke to was of the opinion that I could fill that form out in the negative and say,
you know, it asked if you pled guilty, and you'd pled guilty. So what do you have to ask anybody about?
Well, I understand that I didn't think I ever had a valid guilty plea. I didn't actually understand
what
the point.
It wasn't set aside. You had a guilt. You hadn't had it set aside. It was there. Whether you'd have to do it when it was set aside is a different question.
But
you'd pled guilty.
I completely understand that and agree with you at this time. I get maybe it was some stubbornness within my mind. I didn't think that I had a guilty plea or a felony or any of those things. Once we went through the trial in 2014 in front of Judge Perrigo, once I went through these disciplinary hearings, all those types of things, I understand now, and don't deny this in any way, I understand now that when I filled out that candidacy form, I probably should have said yes, that I had pled guilty. I don't deny that in any way in front of you guys. I'm not going to sit here and say, but at the time, my argument is, at the time, I did think that I was eligible, and I did think that I appropriately answered that question. I don't believe that to be the case anymore. I don't deny that in any way. I do think that it was, that since that time, a court has agreed that I didn't knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently enter into that.
What was the procedure you used in 2016 to vacate a plea that was 20 years old and resulted in an SIS that you had successfully completed probation for?
What's that for?
I had first filed a simple motion to set aside and vacate under rule. You know what the rule number is, escapes me off the top of my head. I eventually ended up filing extraordinary writ of
habeas
corpus. I'm sorry, it's escaping me right now. I'm very nervous, and the saying that a person who represents themselves has a fool for an attorney is absolutely true. I would be better off to have somebody representing me, but couldn't get anyone to do it. It doesn't matter why. But that is the means that was set aside. At that hearing, as the judgment says, you all have a copy of the judgment. The original judge agreed with that, and every judge and prosecutor who took part along the way agreed that it wasn't voluntarily at the time. As far as the reasons for a one-year suspension that Mr. Rapp stated that there was no evidence or credible evidence as to why I answered that question in the negative, as was disclosed to him and what I said to you guys just now. My reasoning was I thought I was allowed to answer that question in the negative based on conversations with the Ethics Commission, a judge there locally, and as well as the statutes 610, 105, and 110.
Mr. believe Rapp has called the credibility of that explanation into question by stating that the Ethics Commission specifically provides it will provide written opinions, but you didn't get one, that you didn't present any evidence from the judge, that you didn't cite those statutes.
And I have attempted to get that from the Ethics Commission. I sent off recently to get them to send me a formal opinion. I did receive a phone call just the other day that they will not give me a formal opinion. They don't believe that it is their obligation to give me a formal opinion of, as to whether I am eligible or not to run for prosecutor back then or currently, and that they believe that that is something that needs to be decided by the courts. They stated that they had sent me, were sending me a letter to memorialize that in writing. I haven't received the letter yet. I realize that this is late, but if that needs to be supplied to the court as soon as I get it, I can supply that to the court and to Mr. Rapp. But they are not going to supply me with a formal opinion, and I have requested it under the statute that Mr. Rapp cited. Other than that, I'm not sure that there's anything else I can do in regards to that at this point. As far as the Cruz case and multiple explanations, I don't believe that I've ever had multiple explanations. I even though before I ever applied to law school, was informed that the same thing, that I didn't have to disclose this because it was an SIS plea and that's supposed to be a sealed file, that I could say I've never been convicted, all of those types of things. I still disclosed this 1996 case to every law school I applied to. I disclosed it to every bar that I applied to take the examination at. I was never trying to hide these things from anyone and never thought that this is something that wouldn't come out during the course of the election. I knew that the alleged victim still lived in the area. I knew her mother lived in the area. I knew that there were people that knew about this. This all took place in Vernon County, the same county that I ran for prosecutor. So I just wrongfully believed, I know wrongfully at this time, wrongfully believed that I could answer that question the way I did. As far as the public interest and public interest being protected, as soon as the Judge Perrigo informed me that I was being removed from the ballot, I didn't appeal that decision. I, at that time, realized that I couldn't run in that election. It didn't appear I could. And so there was still time for another candidate to be placed on the ballot so that the residents of Vernon County could still vote between two different candidates. I knew there was time for me to step aside, and so I did. Were there some motives in there that may be considered selfish as far as stepping aside? Seeing how I knew it was better for the community, but I don't deny at the same time that, you know, being completely candid to the court, that I had reason to step aside also. The negative effect this had, I had a daughter in middle school, a daughter in high school, a son in elementary school, that these things were being stated in the paper, and they were hearing about this. They didn't know anything about this. I never told them. And so the effect it was having on my family, I thought that I did need to step aside for that reason also. As far as being contacted by the newspaper and making this statement that's been attributed to me, That newspaper called me. They left a message on my phone. I tried to return the call. To this day, I've never been contacted. There was a comment attributed to me that I never made. There was a comment attributed to me last month that I never made to this same newspaper from the same reporter. I never made a comment to the newspaper. Had I done so, I have no reason to say otherwise right now. I'm admitting to everything as far as what took place. You know, Mr. Rapp mentioned something also in regards to the Duke lacrosse case. That comparison just doesn't make sense to me. That Duke lacrosse case was something where some false allegations were made by a prosecuting attorney. I never did any such thing, so I don't really understand the comparison. As far as the ADA standards and the dishonest motive, I don't believe I ever had any dishonest motive. I really thought that I was eligible. As hard as that may be to believe, that was my belief at the time. I had always been told that I could answer no to that plea. Since then, I've learned that that's not the case. When I represent criminals in criminal defense and they enter into an SIS plea agreement, I thoroughly inform them of what can happen by entering into that plea. I do not tell them that you have a clean record, that you don't have a conviction. I let them know you don't have a conviction, but you are far from a clean record. These things will come up again in the future. As far as had I been elected to further burden on the county, I can't really make an argument in regards to that, because for when I wasn't elected and when I was told to step aside by a judge, I did. And the allegation that I've never admitted any wrongful conduct, I think I've admitted to you guys today that I should have said no on that form. I didn't realize it at the time, but I absolutely realize it today.
What exactly were you told by whatever entities you consulted about the nature of the SIS that allowed you, that led you to believe that you could answer no to the plea question? I understand the conviction question. That led you to believe you could say no to the plea question?
When I asked a particular judge, and I can name him if you want. I guess his name's within the brief, but I wasn't trying to name him anyway. His statement to me, as well as my former public defender who I contacted, who's now an attorney in St. Louis, their statements to me was that because it was an SIS plea agreement, that I am was always able to answer that question no.
Answer what question no?
The question that was on the candidacy form. I specifically had the form and showed it to the judge. He saw the form and saw what the question was. And was had I been found guilty, pled guilty, or been convicted.
Right. And I have a hard time imagining the conversation between you and any of these people where they said to you, no, where it says, did you plead guilty to a felony, you could say no, though you had pled guilty to a felony.
I don't know what...
Are all those people confused about the difference between conviction and plea?
I don't think that all attorneys and all people are confused in regards to what you're able to admit or deny on an SIS plea agreement, but I do think that on a regular basis that several attorneys and sitting judges are confused about the consequences of what an SIS plea entails. I thoroughly believe that.
You're saying they told you that once you successfully served your suspension and it didn't get revoked, you didn't get executed on that, that it disappeared, but shouldn't you, do you have some obligation to find out by, not by asking somebody, but by doing some research maybe?
Well, the research that I did was I had spoken to an attorney, to a judge and my former attorney. I called the Ethics Commission No one could see anything that said otherwise. I couldn't find case law that said otherwise.
Well, can you? Because that's the exact same question that you answered differently in your law school application and your request for admission to bar. So you're trying to convince me that you got less informed or less intelligent about what that question was asking you after having gone to law school and consulted lawyers and a judge. That's what I'm supposed to believe.
No, Your Honor. I think that I answered the same way by there's some difference there. There is some difference there. Again, when I was asked the question for the law schools, I disclosed it, even though at that time, same thing. I had talked to my former public defender, and she said that she didn't think that I had to disclose it, but I still did. I thought that the law allowed it. It's really that simple. It's not that I didn't know that it existed, and I had always said that I wasn't guilty in the original proceeding back in 1996 in court. I raised issues as to why I wasn't guilty, but the plea was still entered. And by the time 2014 came around, I really thought that I could legally answer that question.
Thank you, sir. You're
the way
out of
I
time.
Did. Thank
you. Briefly to respond to some of the questions asked by the court, Mr. Dunfield's response. I think Judge Draper, Judge Wilson hit the nail on the head about what exactly would this judge have told him, and finding it hard to believe that a judge would have told him that he could answer that question in the negative. And the bigger problem, as I discussed in my brief, is that any statements from this judge were excluded properly by Judge Boniker at the disciplinary hearing panel as being hearsay without exception. So we're here arguing in front of the Supreme Court evidence that was excluded by hearsay. And that's been one of the biggest problems, is if a judge did in fact tell him these things, I have had no opportunity to cross-examine that judge and ask that judge what his belief cycles were. So that's one of the biggest problems. And Judge Stith asked about the ethics opinion, and then also whether he did some legal research as to whether these statutes prohibited him from disclosing this. So the statutes he's talking about are Section 610.105 and Section 610.110, Res Mo. Section 610.105 says an SIS is a closed record, but this court has repeatedly and continually held, starting the Yale versus City of Indianapolis, or Independence case, State versus Lynch, RW versus Sanders, which are not discussed in my brief to the Supreme Court, but are in the record at the disciplinary hearing, that means closed records from the public. And the Yale versus City of Independence case goes on to talk about times when the General Assembly has carved out exceptions where, talking about pleas, it doesn't talk about this specific statute, but pleas of guilty, meaning you have to answer that in response. So the case law doesn't support any of his interpretations, respectfully, Mr. Dunfield's interpretations, that he was not required to disclose this information by statute. Judge Wilson had asked the question about the procedure for getting the plea set aside, and I wanted to respond briefly to that. When Mr. Dunfield was able to successfully get his plea set aside, that was his third attempt at getting that plea set aside. So when he states that every judge and prosecutor agreed that it wasn't correct, that's not true. Judge Perrigo, back in 2014, when he heard this matter, denied his motion to set aside the plea. The special prosecutor, Dwayne Cooper, in that case, specifically argued against it, citing this court's opinion in State versus Cobble. So there's been a long, convoluted process there as well. Briefly, to conclude, Your Honors, I'm quoting from Judge Covington in the Matter of Couples case, where he states that honesty is perhaps the most essential quality for a lawyer. The purpose of disciplinary action is to protect the public, the legal system, and the profession. No sanction less than suspension is consistent with the purpose for which our disciplinary actions exist. That was an honesty case. Respectfully, we would request a 1-year suspension from the practice of law.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Court of Inquiry, I said.